Hello, Jimmy. How are you? I've missed you.
I'm fine, Jazza. How was Asia?
Asia was great. I love that you were like, oh yeah, Jazza's just gone to Asia somewhere. I went to Taiwan, which is a very specific part of Asia.
You probably told me, but, you know, in my standard levels of research,
lack of importance. It's non-Eurocentric, right? So nobody really needs to know that part of the world.
As you said, I hate foreign affairs. So
anywhere
outside of England, really.
Precisely.
It's all the same to me.
We are the Right Dishonourable Podcast. Hello, everyone.
Hello. Somebody tweeted us, Jay Smith, said we should introduce ourselves more
properly. I noticed this, and I didn't understand why you were so confused by this request. But, so here's us fulfilling that request. My name is Jazza. I can be found online.
I think you need your full name, as he said. We're not, you know...
Sure.
Simon and Garfunkel or whatever.
Sure. We're not? I thought that we were the political Simon and Garfunkel, just much less lucrative in our
considerably
escapades.
Negatively lucrative.
My name's Jazza John, and on Twitter, I'm Jazza John, and you can find me there. And I'm also rhyming with oranges on YouTube.
Okay.
Is that enough?
Yeah, I guess so. I'm Jimmy Nichols. You can find me at JDE Nichols. And you
do have the more difficult... like Twitter name to remember.
I'm so just Google Jimmy Nichols Twitter. I'm sure.
How many
come up.
Followers do you have?
600 and something.
That's it. That's small enough to be able to rebrand. I think you need a rebrand.
In what sense? Like pick a new name or
like Honourable Jimmy or something. Or Dishonour Jim, like something that's on brand. We'll talk about this later. So basically, we are the Right Dishonourable Podcast, and we talk about current events. Politics and
social issues.
Thank you. I nearly forgot what the third thing was again. And I've been away for the last 3 weeks, and me and Jimmy haven't really seen each other since. Did you miss me very much?
Yeah, I did actually.
I had to
podcast with John. It was terrible.
Do go back and listen to John's episodes, because John just seems intent on getting us into all kinds of libelous issues.
We're hoping we'll be invited on some panel show at some point, and we can just send John.
Just release him into the wild.
See what happens.
It'll be fantastic. It'll be glorious. So every week we talk about news stories that are prominent in the past week.
Stuff what has happened
in it. And this week we're going to be talking about the Tory Party conference.
Yes.
As one of the thingies.
And also the EU referendum as one of the thingies.
And finally, we're going to be talking about Russia in Syria and the fact that everybody's kind of in Syria at the moment, but nobody's quite sure
except
what
us,
the situation
actually.
Is.
We're not in Syria.
We technically are. Silence, everybody. So shall we play some music and then we can go into the first topic? I don't know why I've got nothing.
Let's do that.
Yes. Go on, then.
So this week, the Tories went up to Manchester to get spat on and pelted with eggs, and also do some conferencing like in between that.
But before we kick this off, did you see the image of like the... He must have been an early 20-something.
The young Tory with egg on his face.
Yeah,
literally.
who was in an immaculately tailored suit. I was quite jealous, I've got to be honest. And he had like a Union Jack little lapel thing coming out.
Someone pointed out he was actually holding an image of Maggie Thatcher as well.
He was holding a paper with Margaret Thatcher like on the front cover. He almost deserved to be egged.
I wouldn't say he deserved it, but
he
definitely invited. I mean, this is like victim blaming of the highest order, but you know.
It is really. If this were a girl with a short skirt, then we'd be chastised quite rightly. So, but anyway, yes, they had an actual party conference where they did party talks and things.
So, there's quite a lot of news points to pick up, but what was the kind of highlight for you? Not in terms of like enjoyable,
highlight.
But in terms of like the most important thing you think happened at the Tory conference, other than that guy with the egg.
I feel like in like the early 90s and like the mid, and maybe like late 80s perhaps, I could have probably voted Tory, I think. Mm. Because there's some things about like the Tory narrative that I empathise with. And every time that conference season comes around, I'm like, no, No, I really dislike them.
See, a lot of people would have said this was kind of a rehashing of the Thatcherite brand in a lot of ways.
Yeah, but Cameron wants to be completely separate to that. So he wants to be seen as a social reformer who is kind of doing good for the country and not like the hardline, must-do ideological cuts guy that he actually seems to come across as.
Well, a lot of people said, like, centre-left rhetoric and actually slightly more right-wing policies. Mm-hmm. There's obviously, like, the whole the gay marriage thing doesn't really fit in with that.
Yeah.
But, cuts to tax credits, for instance. Even actually like that the right to buy housing ISA thing. I know
that. Did you see the map that was so basically Cameron? Did they announce it at conference?
It was floated in like the July budget, I think. But
yeah.
I think they
so this is like
a
right to buy that is going to be helping first time buyers get on the housing ladder. And somebody, I think it was the Independent. No, it was Shelter. Who released a map that showed all of the councils where you would be able to buy a first-time home or to put down a deposit on a first-time home on the new British living wage.
Right.
And there were four councils in the whole of
the
UK.
So was there one in London and then three in the north?
There was one in London, one in Hull, one in Liverpool somewhere.
Yeah.
But the rest of them was like, no chance. So excellent, we're all moving to Hull. Very exciting. But we've gone off topic completely already, but over.
I don't think so. It is this point about George Osborne is staging a massive land grab, at least in terms of the rhetoric for like the centre-left policies.
Well, he's been trying to make Northern Powerhouse happen for a very long time.
Do you think Northern Powerhouse is a thing? Do you think?
So I haven't read an awful lot about this, but he's trying to employ kind of the same tactic that the Mayor of London did in terms of trying to galvanise local businesses in the north for a Trans-Pennine expressway, basically, to link all of the northern cities together.
Right, yeah.
So I genuinely think that is a thing. But then you look at, like, Manchester City Council, they have, like, 90-something councillors, and they're all Labour. And it's like, oh, well, okay. But now, because that's... I believe that his seat is around there.
It is somewhere around there.
It's in like one of the more affluent parts of Greater Manchester.
But if you actually look at the proposals for what he's doing in Sheffield, which is like the second big city he's devolving after Manchester.
Well, Leeds just got...
Has Leeds already?
Yeah. Leeds is meant to be the second city, right? Isn't it? Leeds!
I thought Birmingham was like... Oh, yeah. It doesn't matter. But
Birmingham isn't the north. Did you not hear the Twins episode where we talked about it?
It's all the north to me.
Oh, God. Well, that's offensive. Okay.
But yeah, like the Sheffield mayor is basically what the London mayor is, which is a glorified transport commissioner, basically with like a bit of strategic planning thrown in, which is kind of like housing planning or whatever. It's like you get to draw up a map of where you want things to go and then people can ignore it in the future.
Like in the city.
Yeah, basically. And there is quite a lot of money in this. So like Sheffield is going to get £30 million a year over the next 30 years under the devolution plans. So there is something behind it, but I'm a little bit, I don't really understand it from a Tory, like from a Tory point of view, because I can't see the ideology behind
well,
it
the
or
big
anything
thing,
like
the
that.
The big thing that the mainstream media have been talking about over conference season has been now that Labour are left and loony, their Conservatives now have a chance to grab all of the middle ground and become what
has often
been called the like default party of government.
The natural party.
The natural party of government. And I think that they are... kind of succeeding in that. If Theresa May hadn't made her really kind of borderline xenophobic speech on immigration.
Someone pointed out that she made similar comments about immigration back in 2010.
Yeah.
And she's had 5 years at the Home Office in which to do something about her issues with migration and... She's shit at it. She just, like...
Yeah, it was like...
However you feel about migration, she hasn't
brought
the numbers down.
There's too many migrants. Well, Tessa, if only we'd had somebody at the helm in the Home Office, perhaps, who was able to curb the amount of migration we had over the past 5 years. If only... Oh, wait, it was you. Whoopsie-daisy.
I think she has a problem in that the only way to reduce migration is to leave the EU, and she hasn't yet announced where she really stands on that issue. She's one of these kind of grey area Tories that could could go either way at this point.
But the thing is, everything, like, she was giving out facts that were wrong. She was saying that wages are undercut because of migrants, and
very low wages can be affected in the short
but,
term. By and large, it doesn't really matter. I agree.
And then the fact that there are people... She pandered to the fact that people believe that immigrants come here for benefits. Isn't really true at all. And it was so clearly... So it was clearly posturing, and a lot of people saw that as, Teresa, I want to call her Tessa. So Tessa was trying to kind of position herself as a right-wing candidate to be the next Tory leader. Now, I don't think that this is necessarily correct. I don't think that all of this posturing that we have apparently seen at the Tory conference was necessarily posturing for the next leadership. I think that's just because we quite like leadership elections in this country because it's personalities. I think it was them trying to be good cop, bad cop.
In the case of Boris Johnson, though, his whole raison d'etre since he entered politics, really, is to become leader of the Tory party and prime minister of the country. Yeah. So, in his case,
I would agree with somebody like Boris, but he's still mayor of London and is still yet to have like a seat at the top table in cabinet.
Doesn't he have some sort of observing position?
He gets to sit in the same room or something.
You could sit in the same room so long as you don't say anything.
A lot of people saw like the Theresa May hardline speech as like her saying, "This is the part of the Tory party that I want behind me so that I can then become the next leader." Whereas I think that it may have been something more calculated, where the Prime Minister was being seen as, like, the good, lovely, all fluffy, and then Theresa was deliberately trying to kind of keep the right wing on board. What do you think?
That's pretty clever, I think. Mm. But
do you think they're that clever? Am I giving them too much credit?
Is that clever?
I don't know, they managed to win a bloody election, so...
But actually, at conferences like if you actually watch the John Harris from The Guardian does this amazing video of like he went to the Tory conference and he went to the Labour conference before, and there's a bit in the Tory conference video where he compares like the different attitudes of like the Labour supporters and the Tory supporters and why Labour lost the general election, and it's obvious like the certain types of people are attracted to these conferences and they tend not to be moderates, put it that way. So yeah, I
don't know. I heard that the Lib Dem one was mainly just quite a lot of karaoke.
Did you see the video of them like the Glee Club singing things?
Oh, Jesus, what party have we joined, Jimmy?
I'm keeping like a safe distance from them at this point. Like, I am a card carrying member, but yeah.
Yeah, as am I. Yeah. Like whatever. What were the standout things that you took from Tory conference shizzle?
Mostly it's the positioning thing, I think, because particularly Cameron's comments about Corbyn being a security endangering, Britain-hating ideologue.
That was terrible, because that was deliberately... He knows that that quote was taken out of context.
Yeah,
specifically
he
one about Osama bin Laden, where Corbyn... has been misquoted as saying that the death of bin Laden was a shame, and he actually said that it was a shame that he wasn't able to be taken to trial.
He said it was a tragedy. But what if you take the full quote, and we did a piece on this on the site, is it's very
like dishonourable.com.
Yeah. We can link to it in the show notes, but
can we?
We can, but we might not. But anyway, the full content of the quote is, as you just said, he's saying the escalation of violence and the fact that bin Laden wasn't put on trial was the tragedy. It wasn't his death per se. But actually, Boris Johnson, in December of 2001, wrote a piece for The Telegraph where he basically said, if British or American soldiers find bin Laden, they shouldn't just execute him on the spot. They should try and capture him and try to bring him to trial in New York, where he can be put to death, because New York at that time still had the death penalty.
Well, hey.
Boris Johnson, the famous social liberal, at work there. But yeah, I mean, it's a complete mischaracterisation. I'm sure Cameron knows it, but I'm also sure that he knows that's the only bit of the Tory conference that most people will see. So yeah, I think that the main point of interest
is
the positioning.
So that's the thing that makes me But I hate to be so partisan about it, and I wish that the Tory party didn't make it so easy for me to be partisan about it, but I hate how happy they are to spin. And I think that that happens with any party that's in government, right? They want to spin things. But that is really deliberate lying and misconstruing of the facts for your own political gain, and that isn't fair.
But if you want to ask why the Tories are the natural party of government, I think it's because they are willing to do things like that. And when you look at the conference and the conference videos, it's all very corporate, it's all very professional. And
lots of them standing with their legs very far apart.
Yeah, a bit weird.
Which was a bit weird. If you haven't seen the images, I will try and leave some photos.
It's like the George Osborne power stance.
Yeah, and Theresa May was doing it as well. And it was like, for both of them to do it, and to stand with like their legs slightly more than shoulder width apart.
I mean,
somebody must have said, do that. I feel like that must have been coordinated in some way.
Well, I read somewhere that it's a thing that George Osborne does because, like, the stance kind of... It's like a psychological thing. It puts you in the mood to, like, give...
I'm rolling my eyes.
Like, corporate wankery or whatever. But,
yeah, but it works, though.
It probably does work, yeah. Mm-hmm. Like a lot of corporate wankery, so...
Yeah, so...
I feel the main thing that we need to discuss is the thing we're going to discuss in the next segment.
Yeah, so begin to segue into Europe?
Should we just go without music interlude? Or you can stop it here.
Yeah, music interlude here. So, Europe.
Okay, yeah.
The official Leave campaign was launched this week.
One of the many official Leave campaigns was launched. Actually, at the moment, there's only two.
Are there not three?
Well, UKIP's position is a bit opaque on the whole thing because Nigel Farage has not been included in either of the campaigns, although they have. So there's two campaigns. Let me kind of give the rundown. The Vote Leave campaign is the one that was just launched, and that has the backing of a bunch of MPs from Labour, the Tories, and Douglas Carswell from UKIP.
Oh, a doggy. I do like Douglas Carswell. I just disagree with him on anything, but I think he's sweet.
Okay. Yeah. that's very admirable of you to dissociate the politician from his views. The Vote Leave campaign also has the backing of three major donors, one from Labour, one from Tories, one from UKIP.
Yep.
So it's got a lot of money. It is the Westminster establishment campaign to leave Europe. The other campaign, leave.eu, which was called the No until they rephrased the question, which meant they had to redo all their branding, which is funny. That one is backed by Aaron Banks, who's another UKIP donor, and that is the one that is it's a coalition of various anti-EU groups, and that's the one that UKIP endorsed at their conference. So those are the two main campaigns. But as I said, Nigel Farage...
It's kind of a one-man campaign to leave.
He's got, like, he's taking a show on the road, like,
I haven't seen him go to,
like, various venues, like a sort of Corbyn campaign, like, I'll go to speak at various events. We should try and get down to one.
Oh, my God, can we? I know the youth leader. I'll give him a text.
Yeah, do it, yeah.
Jack Duffett, and he was lovely. He was a sweet... Maybe we'll get him on the podcast. That'll be good.
Did you want to tell them about the In campaign that's launching, that's just launched this weekend?
Or... I don't know about that
You
one.
Don't know?
No, okay. I only heard about the Out one. So you can tell me all of the information, and I will just... It'll be like YouTubers react.
I was hoping that you'd know more about it. I know that Will Straw, who's the son of Jack Straw, and the founder...
One of the Labour princes.
One of the Labour princes, founder of Left Foot Forward, which is a left-wing political website. He's like the one directing the campaign. They've also got the M&S
the ex-M&S guy.
What's his name?
Lord Rose.
Okay, Stuart.
Some
Stuart
guys
Rose
have like some of these lords have fantastic names.
I mean, that is a good name for
Lord.
Lord
Rose, yeah. Lord Adonis, like just glorious surname. So far it looks like we might be leaving the EU, right?
Yeah, because the polling is actually, for ages, it was like, remain. And just in the last 2 months, it's switched so that it's very... One poll says we're going to leave, one poll says we're going to stay. But there's still like 10 to 15% of people who don't know. Mm. And you'd expect them to trend towards the status quo in the end. But yeah, at the moment, like 2 years from now, who the fuck knows what the polls will say.
I'm genuinely terrified. And I will have an existential crisis. And so probably become Spanish.
Why do you... Why do you feel so bad about the prospect of us leaving the EU then?
Because I worked in international trade, and the UK... And it was my job, basically, to pitch the UK as a point of investment to, like, East Asian companies. One of the main reasons that the UK and London specifically is a really attractive place for especially new entry companies to do business is because we are a springboard into the EU, and we are a really good place to test the EU market, and that would not be as easy if we were not part of that infrastructure.
I mean, I used to interview, like, American startups who were just making their first forays into the EU market. They started in London, obviously, because British culture, American culture, a bit more overlap, no language barrier as well. But they would often...
We all watched Friends in the 90s.
Yeah, they would often say, "Where this is like our first foray into the European market, we're going to move into the EU later."
Yeah.
But I actually chatted to some of them about the prospect of us leaving the EU, and although a lot of them said, "Yeah, it's a really fucking stupid idea," they also said that there's already things to do with, like, currency conversion, and admittedly, the trade barriers would undoubtedly go up, but I'm not sure it's as dramatic a change as people are saying.
So it wouldn't, but it also means that we'd then have to negotiate separately from the rest of the EU on stuff like TTIP, and it would mean that we would inevitably be affected by the implications of something like TTIP is the transatlantic trade and investment partnership between the US and the EU, and we wouldn't have a say at the decision table there. And taking, like, pulling the rug out of our feet on the biggest trade deal in human history just seems completely stupid to me.
But we're still, what, the sixth biggest economy in the world? It's not like people always compare it to Norway, but we're actually a much more significant country than Norway
economically. We are, but we can't... We have nowhere near the same amount of clout on the international stage as we did probably in the 70s and the 80s.
Mm.
And also, when compared to giants like China and the USA, of course we can go around to each individual country and do an individual trade deal with them, but we are stronger when we get banded together in the EU when it comes to stuff like trade. And then that's not even going into the cultural benefits of being able to live and work in different countries. Stuff like the Erasmus scheme, which means that you're able to study in foreign countries significantly more easier and all of that kind of stuff. I cannot imagine being persuaded to vote to leave.
But there's a general trend going on in... actually just in Western politics in general, this kind of nativism that's kind of crept back in terms of anti-immigrant sentiment, and also in terms of a backlash against globalisation, both on a trading level and on a cultural level as well.
I don't feel like that is the argument, especially from people like UKIP, though. They say that we can still be an outward-looking nation by calling all of the shots ourselves.
But, I mean, you know the sort of people who vote for UKIP, and actually a lot of them... I see that as a bit of a gloss, really. I'm fairly ambivalent on the EU question, but it seems to me that there's people that actually feel the whole globalisation thing, particularly with the immigration, it's changed this country, particularly in London. It's made London less English. I'm not saying that's a bad thing, but there are certain people who do think that's a bad thing.
I know, and that specifically is really difficult because they don't recognise the country that they live in, and I try to understand that. I don't, but I kind of try to empathise with that point of view.
Well, for us, this is the London we've grown up with.
Yeah, exactly.
Isn't it? So there's no reason particularly that we would care, except in this kind of nostalgic sense.
And exactly.
And you see that with
polling as well. Younger people who are younger are more likely to vote to stay in the EU.
Yeah, I mean...
Which is very interesting when you kind of compare and contrast it with, like, the Scottish referendum. Which was like people wanting to change the status quo if you were younger, more likely to change the status quo. Whereas here, we want to keep the status quo if you're younger.
But I think that's in terms of the whole positioning of the whole SNP's argument was, oh, perfidious Englishmen, like, keeping us down.
No, but you have a similar argument with Brussels having too much power and taking it away from the UK and keeping us down.
I suppose that's true, but a lot of young people don't buy that argument, do they? I mean, the whole SNP thing was anti-Thatcherites, basically. It's like England's been captured by the Thatcherites, both in Labour and in the Tories.
Mm-hmm.
It's all over, we need to dislodge ourselves. Whereas a lot of people don't have that... there's no equivalent argument for, like, young English people towards the EU, I don't think.
So where? So it's the English that are inevitably going to decide this referendum.
Yeah, I mean, it's like,
what do you think characterises the English voter then? Do you think that little England kind of mentality is going to kick in? We're fucked and we're going to leave.
It could go either way at this point. I mean, what we found out in the Scottish referendum is that once the referendum starts going in terms of the election campaign, it changes the way people view their country. It's not a static thing. It's when like the Scottish referendum was arranged, only a third of Scots actually supported independence. By the time it came to the election, it was almost half.
Yeah.
And I feel we're already at around half now, so it could go very far one way or very far the other.
Tying this back to what we talked about previously with the Conservative conference, so we think that Theresa May and Boris Johnson are going to be heading up the Vote to Leave campaign. Do you reckon?
So the way I see this is that Osborne and Cameron have both shackled their fates to staying within the EU.
If they love that. I like that imagery.
it's right, isn't it?
Completely.
Osborne can only succeed Cameron as leader of the Tories and Prime Minister if we stay in the EU. Yeah. If we leave the EU, Cameron's fucked and Osborne's fucked.
Yeah.
They're from a strategic point of view, and Boris is a very strategic politician, he should head up the Leave EU campaign, because if we stay...
Put all of his eggs in that...
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That's the only option he's got at this point. Mm-hmm. I mean, I suppose, hypothetically, he could wait it out another parliament and see if he can dislodge Osborne, you know, 10 years down the line, but...
He technically... What I don't understand is why George Osborne is all of a sudden incredibly popular. That's really confusing.
Because he's seen as the guy, wrongly... Steadily steering the ship. What actually happened...
Shackles and ships. I'm loving this pirate metaphor.
What actually happened was that he slashed public spending, which damaged the economy in the first 2 years... did a U-turn, which almost nobody seems to have noticed, and then up public spending, and then the economy was okay for a little while, and now he's going back down the public spending route because he has a mandate to do it.
Because ideology. EU-wise, what do you think needs to be done? Because we both want to stay in, right? I think you less vehemently than I do, but you still want to stay
in. I'm probably edging staying in. Like, if there was a vote today, I'd probably vote to stay in.
Uh-huh. Okay, what would change your mind, do you reckon?
I don't think very much...
What do I need to do to keep you on side, Jimmy? This is something I might be able to win you over with. The monarchy question.
I don't have, like, this romance for, like, the European... super states, which ultimately I think the problems with the EU, which is that democratically it's a total shit show because of the way it was set up. I don't think that's reformable in the short term. It might be reformable in the long term. Mm-hmm. But what it will entail is making EU less of a confederacy, which is what I think it is now, and more of a full-blown federation with more centralized powers in Brussels.
For those in the monetary union, right?
Yeah, but I think that's also a problem, is that I don't really buy this whole thing that Britain can actually continue as a second-tier state. I think that position will continue to be very uncomfortable for us. Mm. Even if the EU referendum goes like the Remain way, it won't settle anything, I don't think. It will be like the Scottish referendum.
Yeah, it'll be like the Scottish referendum. We'll keep on rabbiting on about Europe. Well, anyway, what do you guys think? Let us know on Twitter. You can find us at Right Dishonour, or you can go to our individual Twitter pages and sling insults at us accordingly at JDE Nichols for Jimmy, or at Jazza John for Jazza. Who'd have thunk it? What are we going to talk about next? Russia.
Russia.
Yeah. Ruski. Да, до свидания. Vodka.
That's very offensive.
Borscht. Okay, so basically, there is currently a civil war in Syria,
yeah.
Which are the rebels versus Assad. So Assad is generally seen as quite a nasty character because human rights abuses, blah, 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 torture, gas, use of nasty things, etc., etc., etc. The rebels include, as well as people who we could probably learn to get on with, ISIS,
yes.
Who, in case you haven't noticed,
rather unsavoury and throw homosexuals and sexually active premarital women off of really tall towers and kill them. So, slight awkwardness there, where the West has kind of decided, so Bashar al-Assad, we don't like you, we're not going to help you. Thus, we're going to help the rebels. But by helping the rebels to defeat Assad, we're also kind of weakening Assad in the fight against ISIS.
Yeah.
So ISIS, rather than having two enemies, now only have one enemy, and also have accidentally probably been... This is not certain, but there's suggestions that ISIS are probably accidentally being armed by the arms that we're giving the rebels.
Brilliant.
Shitstorm, basically. Oh, and also that's why we have a refugee crisis in Europe at the moment, because everybody's running for their fucking lives.
Hooray.
Enter Vladimir Putin, unfortunately clothed completely. He has decided, you know what, Syria is of interest to us. It's one of our... It's in the Caucasus, so it's very close to Russia. Is it on the Russian border? I don't think it's on the Russian border.
I don't think so, no.
But Russia has close ties with Bashar al-Assad's regime anyway.
Yeah.
Putin has been like, yo, West, you're kind of fucking this up, aren't you, really? He's also terrified of Islamic extremism in his country, because his country also has a high Muslim population. And so he's been like, you know, fuck this, we're going to go in and do the Russian thing and just... and bomb all of the rebels.
So at the moment, all of the rebels. At the moment, Russia's bombing... Well, they say they're bombing all of the rebels, but they're not. That's not necessarily true. And the Americans are bombing...
They missed a couple of times.
The Americans are bombing a lot of the rebels... Well, not the rebels, but bombing ISIS. I should say. France are doing the same at the moment. The UK is helping with airstrikes, but only on the Iraq side of the Iraq-Syria border.
Yeah,
is that right?
Exactly. So we are committing airstrikes against ISIS, but only in Afghanistan and in Iraq.
Yes.
Because
is
we
ISIS
voted...
in Afghanistan?
ISIS, part of ISIS, I believe, is in Afghanistan.
I thought that was Al-Qaeda. Like an Al-Qaeda, or is that the Taliban? We're not doing well. There's a lot of players to keep track of.
Shut up. So, yes, ISIS are in Afghanistan.
Okay, so there's a lot of bombing going on. Everyone's having a great time.
So the reason that we aren't partaking in the strikes in Syria is because we had a very public vote against it.
Yes, we actually did quite a long episode on that, which was quite good. If you want to go back and view that on YouTube.
That was one of the ones that was actually on YouTube. Yeah. Do you think we've made the right decision? In retrospect, hindsight is 2020.
I sort of thought it was a bad decision at the time. I think on balance, I mean, the thing about the whole Syria vote, it was very politicised here. Like, Ed Miliband used it as a way of apologising for New Labour's invasion of Iraq, which people are always, generals are always fighting the last war, right? And politicians, it's exactly the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
But we've now let it escalate. I mean, a lot of people, I was reading a piece, I think, in The Guardian today where... Some Eurocrats were saying, oh yeah, we knew the Syrian refugee crisis was going to happen. We've known this for a couple of years.
Oh, that would be nice for you to tell us.
It would have been good, right? It would have been good. But we've, because of the past misadventurism of America and Britain, we've now like kind of surrendered the moral advantage and the strategic advantage in Syria.
Mm-hmm.
And it's now even more of a clusterfuck than if we had entered earlier. Mm-hmm. But the trouble was... that there just wasn't the political will within America or within Britain for any president or prime minister to really sustain a long-term military campaign.
Yeah.
I mean, you remember when Obama decided, okay, we actually need to do something about ISIS now. He said, this is not something that's going to be a few years, this is decades, basically. And that's the attitude that we should have had when Assad was gassing his own people. It was like, okay, we need to not just invade this country, we really need to occupy this country in a sense.
Yeah.
And it's been a total shitstorm since then. Basically.
What do you think about the Russians deciding that we've kind of fucked everything up royally and that they need to step in and help out?
I say help out, do their own thing.
We're helping. We're helping.
Yeah. Well, I don't think that's their goal at all. I think they've just seen Western incompetence and have been like, guys, like, step aside, we'll sort it out. I'm actually leaning towards, I think, that Russia has got the right idea. Do you think that we should be, the question was, do you think that there is a case to be put forward for supporting Assad in his civil war against the rebels, including ISIS, and making him stronger so that there isn't a power vacuum in which ISIS can step into?
Yeah, I mean, there probably is, but it depends.
Could you be won over to that argument? Because I think that's the argument that I actually land on the side of, to be honest. I think every now and again you have to pick your battles.
I don't know. I suppose it's a question of at what point does somebody's behaviour cross the line from, okay, we know you're a horrible man, but we're going to have to put up with you because the alternatives are worse, to, okay, you've actually crossed that. Was that the red line kind of rhetoric that Obama used in the past? You've crossed that line where actually you're no, whatever the strategic advantages of propping you up, it is no longer possible for us to, you know, to leave the country in the state it's in.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, it's immensely complicated and there's too many players and variables, and it turns out I'm not an expert in Middle Eastern
I don't feel like you have to be. I feel like the decision to be had here is whether or not you kind of play the long game, which is potentially propping up Assad and like having him, and unfortunately having somebody like him on side, which is actually what we end up doing with places like Saudi Arabia, and we did with Iraq before we ended up invading. And we were like very happy to support those regimes and kind of look the other way because the region was stable. And I feel like stability is the most important thing for places like that, because we've seen where there isn't stability, that is precisely where ISIS ends up thriving.
Yeah, you can definitely look at it that way. And obviously the fact we destroyed Iraq is the reason that ISIS managed to manifest itself, and also the instability within Syria as well. I don't know that I'm really happy with leaving those sort of regimes in power. I mean, I'm not a massive fan of our relationship with Saudi Arabia. Your point is totally right. Yeah. That actually there's definitely advantages to be had. There's stability, but I guess you have to ask at what cost. But then it comes down to is there the political will to actually go in and effect proper long term regime change? Probably not.
No, but then also you kind of have to say, what right do we have? We don't own this part of the world anymore.
It depends how much of an aggressive liberal you are.
A bit of an oxymoron?
I don't think so. I mean, two examples that I would give, and this isn't by any means my original thinking, this is like Niall Ferguson's sort of thesis, is that if you look at Germany and Japan post-World War II, the Americans did occupy those countries, and they did affect, you know, huge cultural changes in some ways, but also infrastructure changes, institutional changes. And now both of those countries are, you know, they respect human rights by and large, and they're very economically productive countries.
But you know what did happen. So specifically, I'm thinking about places like Taiwan and South Korea that had huge influence from the US. They were dictatorships for about 50 years after the Second World War because they were stable. Because otherwise there would have been a huge chance of communism being able to win in that part of the world, and that was an incredibly important narrative in the Western ideal. We were capitalist, they were communist, we were good, they were bad.
So your view is that we should prop up Assad and hope to affect,
and play the long game.
Play the very long game and actually...
And then you see what happens in places like South Korea, which have a thriving democracy.
So what was it that changed South Korea from a dictatorship to a democracy then? After those years.
So gradual calls from the people. So it was generally non-violent, and it was calls from the people to get representation within government. Mm. And in some, I know less about South Korea, but in Taiwan they gradually had regional elections, and then it went further and further up until finally they had their first presidential election in 1996, I believe.
But when you look at like a country like China, though, people have been talking about like the rising middle class in China eventually going to start demanding democracy, but
no, they don't particularly care.
Exactly. That this is my point, is that there's actually no guarantee that that's what will happen, even if that is exactly what happened.
But
in South
Korea, I don't think the goal is democracy, is it? The goal is to have a healthy kind of society.
Do you think democracy is a human right then?
No.
This is ultimately the question.
No, because it doesn't. Because democracy doesn't always work. It's not always the best thing for a country or a region or a people. And I'm pretty sure I've used this example on the podcast many times, but China, in the last 30 years, has seen 98% of global poverty reduction has been in China. That would not have happened under a democratic regime for the largest country in the world. That would not have happened because stability was allowed and forward planning further than the next election was allowed because it's a single-party state.
But the reason that poverty was eradicated in China in such large numbers was because of free market economics. I mean,
and the fact that they were able to plan for free market economics, right? They were able to instigate that and put that through.
That's true, but I guess do you think that would have happened under a democratic China? Possibly not.
I mean, so the example of the democratic China is actually Taiwan, because very different, because the population is like 20 million and China is over 1.2 billion now.
Yeah.
But Taiwan basically enacts what was seen as like the foundations of modern China, in terms of like the Kuomintang, who are the nationalist party. They lost the civil war against the communists and then got exiled to Taiwan, and Taiwan is where Chinese democracy now flourishes.
So I
see stability being the most important thing, and then if the people fancy some democracy at the end of that stability, whoop whoop, everybody's happy. But the most important thing is that people, and I hate the idea that business is the most important thing, but people and businesses and governments can get on with their shit. Who cares whether you get to put a mark on a mark in
a box? So you're, I mean, this is in a lot of ways a very conservative point, is that you think that stability and economic gains are more important than civil liberties in terms of free expression.
I think that when you're talking about developing countries, yes, they are more important. We are in a society where we already have a very stable society. We don't need to particularly care about the kind of like implications of the Prime Minister being depicted as somebody who put his willy in a pig, for example. We can all laugh about that because we have a very stable economy and a stable political structure. When those structures are not in place, stability should be the most paramount and most important thing, I think, in terms of international development.
But to flip the argument entirely on its head...
Go on, flip it.
If in this country a government came to power that said, we're going to clamp down on civil liberties and this will in turn create...
But you're comparing apples and oranges, though.
I'm saying, would you in your own life be willing to put up with reductions in civil liberties for economic gains?
No, because our economic gains are fine. The UK and like the developed world is fine.
No, but if it was put on the table, this is the choice, and you're like, okay, well, that actually is the choice. I believe that is the choice. Which would you pick?
I would choose to have my civil liberties because I know that we have a system in the UK that allows for there to be civil liberties and freedom of expression and for us to also be incredibly stable because we have cultivated that over centuries and centuries and centuries. Mm. Whereas when you look at somewhere like Syria, which are basically lines drawn in the sand by us, right? There's actually very little binding quite a lot of these countries together beyond like, this was a region organised and legislated by this British lord once upon a time.
If the thing you said about South Korea and Taiwan is true, that's one way that you can get democracy if that's what you want to do. The other example of Germany and Japan shows that the other route does actually kind of work, although you might say that those countries were... Obviously, Germany is a Western country and Japan was substantially westernised before World War
II. I know less about Germany, but I know that Japan has basically been a single-party state for the past 60 years. Their opposition government has been, like, non-existent. Mm.
But it's still a democracy and it still has substantial civil liberties,
no,
right?
True. But also, when you have an illegitimate opposition party, then how democratic is that?
I guess we're about to find out in Britain, so...
Oh! Corbyn burn!
Corbyn burn.
Is there anything else you'd like to talk about specifically about Syria?
I feel I probably embarrass myself as much as I need to in the segment. So.
Likewise. If you want to correct us on anything that we've said, because we're really good at foreign policy, you can chastise us on @WriteJustOnable, or you can go to the website, writejustonable.com, and leave us a comment. We love comments. We like talking about them and seeing them and talking to
we
you.
Do, yes.
Do that. Also, rate us on iTunes.
Yeah.
We done?
I think we're done, yeah.
Cool. See you next week. Toodaloo.
Bye-bye.
Bye.